Hello, I'm Terence McNally, and welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Paul Howard, producer-director of a new documentary, Infinite Potential, The Life and Ideas of David Bohm, groundbreaking 20th century physicist and philosopher. And you can learn more and watch the trailer at infinitepotential.com. Show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net. There are 77 days until what has long been called Election Day, but if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office under siege, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves at least a two-week margin. So vote by mail, October 20th. As we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I also encourage you to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, and finding ways to help those in your community that are hurt most by the social isolation or the economic devastation that we're now unfolding. Now to today's conversation. The new documentary, Infinite Potential, is that rare work of cinema that, at least for me, made reality more vivid and revelatory. I'd been aware of David Bohm, that's B-O-H-M, David Bohm, and his work for years, and I knew he somehow bridged physics and consciousness. But the film made clear to me for the first time the scientific challenge that he'd taken on to unify general relativity and quantum physics. Both accurately explain observable phenomena, Einstein's general relativity on the macro level, including stars, galaxies, the universe itself, Niels Bohr's quantum mechanics and quantum theory on the micro level, subatomic existence. But quantum mechanics and general relativity couldn't speak to each other, which seems to be rather a disappointment if you're trying to grasp and map reality. But David Bohm saw that both theories have in common cosmic wholeness, and then he built for years on that realization, both in physics and in philosophy. I believe documentary biographies of people of ideas, and that's what this is, are a real challenge. There can be stories that are well worth telling, but they may not meet the sound and visual demands of the medium. How do you show physics? Watching this film, I found myself, however, re-experiencing glimmers of the moments of transcendence in my own life, often that took place in nature, that had intuitively shown me the truth that Bohm sought to explain, and I think that it could evoke that experience says a lot. Born in Ireland, Paul Howard is a film producer, television director, and series producer in Ireland and Australia. For example, in Australia, his projects include Triumph of the Nomads, a dramatic history of Australia prior to the arrival of European settlers, and The Pintubi, a docudrama series about the last remaining tribe of Aborigines who roamed outback Australia up until 1935. And his latest documentary, the one we're going to talk about, is Infinite Potential, The Life and Ideas of David Bohm. Welcome, Paul Howard, to Freeform, a world that just might work. And let me remind listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, July 15th.
Wednesday, July the 15th, it is, Terrence, and I'm delighted to be on your show.
First of all, I'm guessing that our experience these days with the pandemic and isolation and our sense of shared vulnerability is really quite in sync with some of the themes and messages of your film.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the film, its themes, I think, are resonating with a lot of people. And I think those people that have seen the film have said exactly what you've intimated there, that it's a very timely film now for the world that we live in. Because during this pandemic, I think a lot of people are thinking about their relationships to others, relationship to themselves, relationship to nature, to the economy, to business. It's making them think about their place in the world, the work they're doing, all of those kind of things. And of course, one of the big themes in the film, Infinite Potential, and one of the things I think that David Bohm wants us to be concerned about is the household that we all occupy, which is planet Earth, that humanity occupies. And of course, a lot of the ideas that come from David Bohm's physics, or if you like, the implications of the of the philosophy that come from David Bohm's physics, is interconnectivity and our interconnectedness. And you know, when you can understand these things at all kinds of different levels. You can understand it intellectually, and you can look at the physics, and you can look at the philosophy. But when you really come to know and understand these things, then you should be concerned about the planet. You should be concerned about our relationship to nature. You should be concerned about our relationship to one another. Because if we are all interconnected and we're not treating nature in the proper way, or treating each other in the proper way, well, then we're damaging ourselves because we are interconnected. And I think that's one of the big messages, actually, that comes out of the film. But to just get back to where you started, it's a timely message given the times that we're in. And I think that the timing of the film now getting out there is great, because people are reflecting. And I think hopefully the film will reach those people who are reflecting.
Before we return to really, I want to delve into that question just a little more. But before we do, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. I always say I'm not having a conversation with a book or a film, but with a person.
Yeah. Exactly.
So how do you see your path, personally, briefly, to the work you do today? And I don't mean just limited to the film, but what you consider your work in the world. And you can go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, basically, I saw a brief appraisal that you did on the film. I think Susan might have sent it to me.
That's right.
And actually, I think you got it. You know, you really did, because that's very much the way I think about this film. And I've always had a very strong intuitive sense myself. And David Bohm, indeed, had a very strong intuition. And I've looked at lots of footage of David Bohm, and that comes out very strongly, that he was driven by deeper intuitions, and that gave rise to many of his ideas in physics. And as I said earlier, the physics tends to inform his philosophical outlook. But I was always interested in the visual arts, in photography, and I was, you know, very interested in cinema and so on. And I remember, you know, as a kid going to the cinema, and you know, we're less conditioned when you're children, you know, as you tend to absorb a lot as you get older and get into your teenage and adult years, and you're being, you know, continually conditioned, I suppose, by your social and cultural environment and the way you're educated and all of those kind of things. But anyway, there's a certain clarity you have, I think, when you're younger. But I remember when I'd go to the cinema, and the lights would go down, and the screen would fill, the beam would come from the projector and hit the screen. I always lost complete sense of what was around me, and I got completely lost in the reality up on the screen. And that's just like a two-dimensional reality of the film. And it was like you were totally in that reality. And then suddenly, after, you know, 90 minutes or whatever, shock, the lights would come back on, people would shuffle out onto the street. And I found this kind of transition from the world that I was in to re-entering the world of our everyday space and time and three-dimensional space. I always found that a very strange experience. And I think then it was kind of sowing a seed in me where I began to kind of question, how can I be so in that reality up on the screen and then emerge into this other reality? There's kind of two realities there. And I always had this notion that maybe the reality we're in, the three-dimensional reality, is some kind of projection coming from another reality. So I began to think about different dimensions, even from a very early age, and sometimes in a very subconscious way. I mean, I wasn't agonizing over it. But some of my friends were very amused, you know, when you'd be coming back from the cinema in the evening or whatever, and you'd be walking home together, we'd be having this conversation, and I would spin around as fast as I could to see if there was some projector behind me projecting these images in front of me. And, you know, they thought me a little bit strange, but nonetheless were very amused by this activity. But needless to say, I never found that projector, and I accepted the three-dimensional world that we live in, and our sensory perception and all of that kind of thing. But then, you know, in religious class and school as well, you know, you'd be hearing about the kingdom of heaven, and it was one of the classes actually I used to quite like, and there'd be readings from the New Testament, and you'd have Jesus talking about, you know, overcoming the world, and the kingdom of heaven is within, and these kind of things. And I was always kind of fascinated. This kingdom, what is this kingdom? You know, now my father was a great help there, because he was an airline pilot, and he read widely, and he wasn't overly spiritual or anything like that. But I used to catch him reading the Bible on occasion, and you know, I used to ask him about these things, and he'd a very good kind of take on this. He said, well, look, don't see it as a kingdom, but maybe just see it as another dimension, mm-hmm. you know, another dimension that our sensory perceptions in our everyday world can't quite reach. But, you know, but this idea of another dimension, and this kind of cohered with my kind of more primitive idea of this image being projected. That's, in other words, our three-dimensional world is a kind of a projection. But then, lo and behold, some years later, I had the good fortune of traveling with him to London. He was flying as captain of this flight, and I was sitting up in the cockpit behind him, in what I think they call it the jump seat. I remember there was always a free seat up in behind the mm-hmm. captain there.
Yeah.
So there was a first officer captain, and I was up in the back. And anyway, we took off out of Dublin, and we were heading for Heathrow. It was kind of mid-afternoon, I think, when we took off, and we hit some very bad turbulence once we entered British airspace. And so we were in bad turbulence. We were in a thick, dark cloud. I remember my dad telling me that he had to put in corrections because there was a 100 mile an hour crosswind that was pushing us off course. So he was quite focused in making sure that we got to our destination, you know. But I remember, I think he detected I was slightly anxious, and he told me to keep my eye on the altimeter, which is something that tells you your rate of descent. So anyway, we were en route not too far out from Heathrow Airport, and I was just completely puzzled because, like, you could see nothing. We're just in cloud, and we were shaking and buffeting around the sky and so on. And I just said, look, how do you know where you are? You know, at that one point, I just asked this question, how do you know? And he said, count to 15 and you'll see the main runway at Heathrow Airport before you. So I counted down 15, 14, 13, right down to zero. And like an apparition appearing before me, there was the main runway at Heathrow Airport, beautifully lit with runway lights, reflected in the wet. And as soon as I realized that that was the main runway at Heathrow Airport, he said, now count to 15 again and we'll be on the runway. So I counted to 15 and we were on the runway. So as we were taxiing in, I just said, but how do you know? You can't see anything, you know? So with a kind of a mischievous grin on his face, he turned around to me and using a kind of biblical speak, he said, ye of little faith.
Uh-huh.
Right? So it was kind of like, you mean to say you had no faith in me? But actually, I understood what he meant when he said, ye of little faith. And of course, he understood that too, because it wasn't any kind of faith in a religious sense. It was faith in the cockpit instrumentation panels that are based on the physics, basically, that's built into those. And of course, he's trained to read cockpit instruments and he understands the physics and so on. And the point being, of course, that if he tried to land that aircraft using sensory perception alone, we would have ended up in some field miles away from our destination, possibly dead, and or severely injured or whatever. The point being, and the big aha moment for me, was that we misperceive reality through our sensory perceptions.
Mm.
We have to rely on something beyond our sensory perceptions. So this again was triggering the projector projecting into, and the fact of, you know, he talking to me about to see this kingdom as another dimension. So I was always conscious then that there were other dimensions of reality. And this was a big moment for me, the fact that suddenly I realized he could never have landed that aircraft using sensory perception alone. So he was relying on something that was beyond our sensory perception. So it was like another part of this jigsaw was coming together for me. So I began to get more interested in these ideas. And then when they released the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, that took me back into the cinemas, and of course it was a giant cinema screen, and there before me was like the mysterious universe, the quest for knowledge, and in the most beautiful non-verbal way, lots of themes were being introduced about, you know, intelligence, reincarnation, the ending of psychological time. All of these incredible ideas were coming from the screen, and they seemed then to again cohere with this evolving kind of intuition I had. There's something going on beyond this everyday reality that we inhabit. And then, of course, you have to fast forward now.
By the way, let me just say one thing. It's interesting. If someone hadn't seen 2001, they might take you more literally than you actually meant it. That you said, you know, I'm watching these images and it's about this and it's about that. And to someone else, those same images may have suggested something very different.
Exactly.
The 2001, I think, more boldly than most films, was willing to give you images, give you music, give you an experience without telling you what it was.
Exactly. You've got it absolutely right there. And I remember having debates with friends of mine about this film, about the meaning of the film, because Stanley Kubrick, who made that film, he wasn't trying to push anything on you.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't trying to tell you how to think. And it was one of those films that was groundbreaking in the sense that The dialogue was secondary to the to the themes in the film. Like, for example, I don't know if you saw the film or whether whether you experienced it, but they represent intelligence with this kind of monolith, this very symmetrical looking what would you
A
call
large
it?
block of
Yeah,
something.
a large block of something, and it seemed to have this kind of steely sheen that emerged from it. And every time it appeared, there was always this low angle shot, and the sun would be just rising over it. So it was making a connection with something far out in the universe. You know, it was communicated beautifully. And when those apes, those fighting apes at the beginning of the film, they were just fighting without any kind of sense of what they were fighting for. But once one of the apes went up and had the courage to touch this monolith, it was almost like the ape had got some intelligence. And he picked up the bones of a long dead animal that was lying around the place. And he started to play with the bones and realized that he could use this bone now as a weapon to fight off the other opposing apes. So it was almost like the dawning of free will, you know. And the next time the monolith appeared was on the moon, when we had just begun venturing from Earth out into space and the moon travel, and they were even doing a mission beyond Jupiter and so on. But this monolith was very symbolic of some deep intelligence that was out there. And it was just all the themes that were raised in the movie. Like, one of the main characters sees himself aging over a very short period of time. You know, he goes through this time tunnel and he ends up in this house. He's still in a spacesuit, and he goes to the mirror to look at himself, and he sees himself as he would expect to see himself, but he sees somebody behind him sitting at a table, and he looks back, and it's him in advanced years having a meal at this table. And then accidentally he knocks a glass off and it cracks on the ground, and he goes to pick it up, and again out of the corner of his eye, he sees the body of a man on a bed, and it's him on his deathbed, still breathing. And the monolith appears in front of him, and he reaches out to the monolith, and the camera follows his hand as he goes into the monolith, and he emerges as a fetus looking over Mother Earth. And, you know, these are all just powerful visuals, but it's introducing you to the whole idea of the ending of time, the passage of time, and how we read time, and the idea then of the possibility of incarnation, that, you know, we pass through this life and perhaps are reborn again. So, you know, these were very profound ideas, and these were all resonating, if you like, with my deeper sense that there's definitely something, you know, beyond this reality, this that we experience through our sensory perceptions. And then, of course, I ended up in a little medieval village in Italy, and I went into a cafe bar, and I was all alone. And then this other man came into the cafe bar, and he ordered an espresso, and I noticed he had a Liverpudlian accent. From Liverpool. So we got chatting, and soon I learned he introduced himself as David Peat, the physicist who is one of the interviewees in Infinite Potential, the film. And I didn't know anything about David Bohm. In fact, one of the points I perhaps should have made earlier in the conversation was that, you know, I grew up in my earlier years and teenage years and all the rest, and I come from a quite a big family of there's five boys, two girls, and the conversations, you know, around dinner table or the tea table or whatever, they were always interesting conversations about science and philosophy, spirituality, music, whatever, you know. And Einstein, I heard mentioned, and I heard of Stephen Hawking, and I heard the Buddha was mentioned, and mm-hmm. Jesus Christ was mentioned, and lots of different conversations. But did I ever hear of David Bohm? No. And that was, you know, again, when you fast forward, when I met this man, David Pete, in a little medieval village in Italy, he didn't mention David Bohm, naturally, in the first meeting, but I was going back and forth to Italy, and, you know, I see him, and eventually we developed a little bit more, and then he told me he was running conferences in this, seminars and conferences based on the ideas of this physicist called David Bohm. And I had no idea who David Bohm was. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other interesting piece of information actually that I did manage to find out the first day I met him was that I was curious that he was from Liverpool, and he was a good bit older than me, and I said, you must have been a contemporary of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, mm-hmm. you know, because you grew up in Liverpool. And he said, absolutely. He told me that his father was an electrical contractor, and he employed George Harrison as an apprentice electrician. And George Harrison came in one day and tendered his notice, mm-hmm. and said he was leaving to go off and join some obscure band called the Beatles. So that was kind of funny. But anyway, over time, I got to know David Pete. I got to know his wife, and my wife used to come with me to Italy, and we'd young children, and both families got to know one another. So eventually, the name David Bohm slipped in to the conversations. And when David Pete knew I was a filmmaker, mm-hmm. he approached me one day, and he showed me, I think, 3 or 4 pages of a treatment. Now, he had written a book titled Infinite Potential, which was all about, you know, David Bohm. Mm-hmm. But he showed me a few pages, and I kind of read it, I suppose, out of politeness, really, because I was kind of quite busy doing other work at the time. And the idea of even thinking about another project was something I wasn't quite ready for. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But he was very passionate about it, and I remember meeting him another day in a little town away from this village. He was going to the post office with his wife, and I met him. And again, he kind of collared me and mm-hmm. asked me, you know, had I thought about the Bohm Project? And he started to describe to me and to actually act out in front of me. I don't know if you remember that scene in the film, or David Bohm talking when he was a young kid up in the mountains with some of his friends, and they were trying to get across a stream. And most of Bohm's friends just naturally hopped from stone to stone and got across the stream. But Bohm wasn't quite able to do that. The way Bohm thought about things was he had to kind of map things out. But suddenly he had this kind of aha moment, and he realized that, well, if I want to get across the stream, I'm going to have to do it without thinking. Mm-hmm. And he just hopped from stone to stone, and he got across the stream, and he realized later that he said this was a kind of a breakthrough moment for him, that he realized that consciousness is a kind of a moment-to-moment of awareness, instead of being carefully mapped out. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so in other words, it was a continuous motion of movement of awareness. And he said that that then informed his whole approach to physics, which is all about process and emergence and movement. And, you know, we have an interview with Bohm early on in the film where he's describing this. But So that was a big moment for Boehm. But when I met David Peat in this town close to the medieval village where I first met him, he actually acted out that scene for me. He was so passionate about it, and he went over to the green and he said, "Look, you know, and hopping from stone to stone, and this idea of movement and emergence and process and consciousness is something that's never static or complete, but an unending unfoldment, you know." And this, when I saw David Peat's passion for this, I said, "I'm going to just dive into this and learn more about it." So I started to read more, and I naturally read his book, and I read David Boehm, and I became very attracted initially to the philosophical aspects of Boehm, these ideas of wholeness, of
Interconnectedness, yeah.
interconnectivity, all of that kind of thing. And then, you know, I'm not by any means a physicist or a scientist, but I learned, I suppose, the basics to get a kind of a basic knowledge. And as I developed more of an interest in the physics, I could see very clearly that where Boehm's ideas were coming from, that they were philosophical ideas that were emerging from the physics. And then as you learn more about Boehm, you realize how ultimately he had to break with the orthodoxy in physics. You know, if he was to explore these ideas of consciousness, and this is of course then where he leads us into Krishnamurti and his exploration of the nature of thought and consciousness and so on. But the point I'm really trying to make here is that as I got more into learning more about David Boehm, I just felt that this was a project that I could really cohere with. And I really felt that I felt that these ideas were very important. And I think that if I could make a film about David Boehm, that through that film, I might be able to make other people aware of these ideas. And it might, in some small way, create a higher level of awareness in people. Who, you know, are going about their business every day, going to their jobs, whatever they're doing. But, you know, I sort of saw this world, this fragmented world that we live in, where really people, there's a kind of a big collective disconnect out there, I felt. And I felt that Boehm could provide us with some answers to dealing with some of the this fragmentation and perhaps healing and transforming and creating some unity. And I could see how this could emerge from his physics and his ideas of wholeness and interconnectivity. So in a sense, I was very motivated then to get involved in the film and to make this film.
So what I hear, you give us glimpses of your own perception of reality, your perception of dimensions, your perceptions of consciousness, and so on. But then this chance encounter, at least at the first point, with David Peat, begins to crystallize. Now, once you have found that David Bohm speaks to you, that he gives you a way of knowing more or understanding better these notions that you'd been experiencing and playing with for years, that says to me, I think people should know about this. That doesn't say to me, and I know it's the kind of information made for a film. You with me? Once you say, I'm going to take these physics and philosophical notions and make a film about them, that's a big leap. Film is a wonderful narrative medium. It's a wonderful imagery medium. Is it a medium for physics and philosophy? So tell me how, once you sort of went, I'm a filmmaker. If I'm going to spread these ideas, it's going to be through film. But only at that point, you then have to face the challenge of how do I make these sorts of things something people sitting in an audience will grasp and feel compelled to pay attention to.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a lot of ways I guess I could answer that. First of all, I felt motivated myself because I felt that David Bohm, as you said in your question, was speaking to me. And I felt that if I really believed in what David Bohm was speaking to me, and if I was moved by that, and I became quite passionate about that, I felt that I could move others if I could get that message across. Okay? Now, the big challenge, of course, in the film, first of all, it took an awful long time to finance this mm-hmm. film because, you know, most mainstream broadcasters, they feel they know better what their audiences want to hear. Sometimes I feel the very thing that people really need to hear, these are big ideas that are in this film. And, you know, I felt it was my responsibility then to be able to decode these mm-hmm. ideas for a general audience.
And that's translate them in a way.
Translate them, yeah. So the big thing that happened really was I struggled with this to try and get it financed for years. And mm-hmm. then I found an organization whose ethos completely was such a great marriage mm-hmm. with the themes that I was exploring in this film. And I had a very fortunate meeting with the man that's not here today, Jan Wolicek, at a conference in London, which was celebrating the centennial of David Bohm in 2017.
Uh-huh.
And I went up to Jan. I was over there, actually. I was collecting some interviews. In other words, I was advancing the film without any finance, really.
Sure.
I'd some limited finance, right? Mm-hmm. And I knew Roger Penrose was going to be there, and I knew, you know, and he's a superstar in, I suppose, modern physics. And, you know, he took Stephen Hawking under his wing and mentored him and so on. And, you know, he's a big star in modern physics. And Yakir Aharonov was also going to be there. And he worked with Bohm, and Bohm was in Israel. And they worked on the Aharonov-Bohm effect, which was nominated for several Nobel Prizes, actually. But anyway, I was going to this conference, and naturally, since there were a lot of the heavyweights of the physics community coming to London to talk about David Bohm and emergent physics and consciousness. They were discussing all these great ideas. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went to Jan Wolicek, who was cooperating with me actually in setting up the interviews. And so then, you know, at the end of the conference, I just went over to Jan and I said, "Look, Jan, I outlined the project to him and I said it completely coheres with what the ethos of the Fetzer Trust, who were one of the big sponsors of this conference in London." So Jan said, "Look, you know, send me, put it on paper and, you know, the usual thing, send him the treatment and send me some outline budget figures and schedule and all of this kind of stuff." But anyway, I just sent him everything. I sent him a full treatment. I sent him a budget that had the I's dotted and the T's crossed mm-hmm. and schedule and all the rest of it. And I completely forgot about it. A couple of months later, I got an email And he said, "Paul, congratulations, we're going to get behind this film."
Ah.
And this was just like amazing. And the other amazing thing about it was they were going to give me the freedom to make the film that I wanted, because I think they could see in the treatment and the documentation that I supplied that I knew the story, and they could clearly see where I was going with this film. And they could see the earlier efforts I had made to interview many of the people who were in the film, like Paavo Pilkanen and David Schramm, and now I had Roger Penrose and Yakir Aronhov, and I had Basil Hiley, who worked with David Bohm for over 30 years. And, you know, Basil said to me that he would only get involved in this film if I was going to deal with the physics aspects of it, because mm-hmm. he didn't want David Bohm being kind of represented as some kind of new age mm-hmm. philosophy, you know. Because, you know, there's lots of books out there on wholeness, and there's lots of books out there about our interconnectivity and all that kind of thing. But when you get into Bohm, you realize that he's giving us a philosophy for living our lives that is completely consistent with quantum physics. So, you know, you feel that the philosophy is emerging from something much deeper, that it's not just some kind of loose, nice ideas that are put together that sound good. And that whole idea, of course, of emergence was with me since I was a kid, mm-hmm. because I always thought that this reality has got to be coming out of a deeper reality.
Right.
So anyway, then I'm trying to get back to the question that you asked me, you know, how was I going to do this and how was I going to represent this for an audience? Now, suddenly I had the money and I was kind of waving the flag for this project for many years.
Right.
And now I had the money, and then the terror began.
Yeah, of course.
Be careful what you wish for,
right?
Young lad. You know, suddenly I had it, and it was kind of like, oh my God. And suddenly it became an almost a weight on my shoulders.
Of course.
Because it was like Bohm covers so much. He covers physics, he covers philosophy, he covers dialogue, he covers language, education, even getting into the arts, you know.
And politics.
And politics and all of that stuff, you know, and the whole communism period that he suffered through and had to go into exile as a young man. I mean, how terrible is that? But so suddenly it was kind of like, my God, what is I want to say about Bohm? Am I actually going to even represent this visually, right?
Right.
So I assembled, we went off and we interviewed everybody. And when I say everybody, I wanted to get people into the film. I wanted to make it as organic as possible. In other words, I wanted people in the film that had direct experience of Bohm.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that experience. I was, you know, by no means a contemporary of him or the people who worked with him. So, but I wanted to collect as many voices as possible who had worked directly with Bohm. So there was a certain holistic nature mm-hmm. already forming in the film, because I was gathering voices, the voices of people who had worked with him and who knew him and knew what he was about, both on the philosophical side and the physics side of it. But Basil Hiley did say that to me. He said, "Look, Paul, I will support the film and, you know, I will help you in any way I can with the physics and so on, as long as you deal with it."
Right.
You know,
let me ask about that, because I think that my contact with Bohm over the years was more on the philosophical side. I would see his name. I hadn't read deeply into him, but I had seen his name and seen him associated. But if we talk about the physics side, the point that I had not realized was that Einstein's theory of general relativity and the theory of quantum mechanics, here represented by Niels Bohr, that those two theories were pretty much accepted. But, as you point out in the film, they do not speak to each other. They are both these essential theories of reality, and both are accepted, and somehow we allowed ourselves to go, well, I don't exactly know how they fit together, but we'll just live with it. And what Bohm set out to do was to reconcile the two of them.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I'm always reminded by, and again, I get a bit confused on this, whether it was Richard Feynman or Niels Bohr said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you don't understand quantum mechanics, you know? So, and you see, again, that struck a big chord with me, and I'll explain why. Because you have to begin to understand that the assumptions we make in classical physics or in our classical everyday world of relative space and linear time and sensory perception, they actually become obstacles in trying to understand the quantum domain or quantum reality, right? So right at the get-go. There's a big, big problem here. However, the genius of Mr. Bohm was to peer into the quantum world through the prism of undivided wholeness. This notion of undivided wholeness, looking, and when you actually begin to look at both worlds in this way, it dissolves the conflicts and offers a very elegant solution that we deal with in some detail in the film. Now, I should say to you that you've possibly seen the 72-minute version of the film. The director's cut is actually 110 minutes long, and that really delves into the physics and the philosophy that emerges from those physics, okay? Now, I don't necessarily want both films to be in competition with one another, but I just wanted to say that. The director's cut is not out there. It will come out later in the year. And actually, the 110 minutes, depending on broadcaster requirements, might be 255 minutes, in other words, 2 hours, or 425 minutes. And I have ambitions to add, actually, an additional episode on Bohmian dialogue, which was another thing that he got into after his conversations with Krishnamurti and so on. But anyway, and in that film, you see, you've read about the implicate order and the explicate order, presumably, because, you know, Bohm wrote a groundbreaking book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And, you know, once you see, the big issues that you rightly point up in terms of the Einstein view, in terms of general and special relativity, and, you know, everything breaks up at 186,000 miles per second, speed of light, and so on. You know, when you get into the quantum world, and you get into the quantum world with David Bohm, he approaches even something like the two-slit experiment very differently to the way the Copenhagen school.
Oh, and let me tell people one thing, which again was helpful to me to understand, which is that general relativity deals with the cosmos. It deals with reality in its largest manifestation.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Quantum mechanics deals with the atoms and quarks and bosons and things. Reality in its smallest dimensions.
Yeah, the smallest things in the universe.
And so one comes up with a theory that explains the movements and so on of the smallest and one of the largest, and you would hope that they cohere. And when he comes up with the, when he roots it all in wholeness, it seems to me what he's saying is that there is an implicate, that is an implied order underneath the explicate order we see in reality. And to me, it seems like it goes right back to your sensation as a child that there was some dimension underneath, behind, some projection behind what you were dealing with in your three-dimensional world.
Exactly. I think you understand it very well, and actually you put it very well, and I don't think I can do too much better than that. But actually you see, when you come down to basics, the entire universe, both the macro and the micro, are made up of the tiny little bits. Right. Everything is made up of the smallest things. Everything has particles. Everything is made up of particles. Now, when Bohm came up with variables theory, the one that was rejected by the elite,
the establishment,
not because it was wrong.
Yeah.
And of course, you were in the middle of the McCarthy inquest, and Bohm was tainted, and even though he was acquitted, and
right,
he suffered terribly.
So for people, Bohm had attended some communist meetings.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't name names, and back
then, all of that, yeah.
Any of you who have read about Roy Cohn lately or that sort of thing, McCarthy has been in the news, the plot against America and so on. McCarthy has been in the news, but because that was the time when we were when the elite physicists were working on the had been during World War II working on atomic energy and nuclear weapons, he was considered, because of attending a few meetings, he was locked out of sort of the great physics game of that moment.
Exactly. And, even his peers at Princeton and the administration and the college authorities and so on, they didn't want anybody who was associated with any kind of investigations, especially when they had to do with communism, they were considered like extreme left, and they didn't want their students being contaminated with such people. Now, of course, the great irony of all of this is that Robert Oppenheimer himself was a member of communist groups and encouraged. He had a team in Berkeley that were actually a communist group, and they were looking at the communist ideal. And the amazing thing is that he managed to extract himself from that, but he didn't want to be seen to be helping Bohm, who was tainted, even though it was Oppenheimer who brought him into that circle in the first place.
Right.
And very interestingly, many years later, Robert Oppenheimer himself became a candidate for national security advisor in the U.S. And his communist past caught up in him then. He was pushed aside. We can't have somebody who was dealing with the commies, or interested in that. So actually, his past, he survived the initial period, but it did affect his career at a later stage.
We've got to bring this to a close in a couple of minutes. So,
well, can I just cut to the chase then on something here, because this is very important. You were talking about the two realities. Now, the thing about it is, one of the things that comes out of Bohm's hidden variables paper is the quantum potential, which was a groundbreaking idea. Which introduces this idea of the quantum potential, which is a force or energy that arises naturally when quantum phenomena arise. In other words, in the quantum domain. And this energy or force, it conditions the energy of particles, which we're all made of, so that the internal form of particles respond and they are given a condition and context within the whole. The whole meaning the whole universe, because mm-hmm. the whole universe is made of particles. So it's actually the informing action of the quantum potential that allows our physical universe to be and gives rise to the well-defined motions we experience in our world of space, time, and sensory perception. So let's call this the non-local world. And our local world of space, time, and sensory perception emerges from the non-local, right? And this is where we get particles, entangled particles, that a particle at one end of the universe can communicate to a particle at the other end of the universe instantaneously without any signal passing between them. In the local world, in the world of Einstein and general relativity, we're dealing with signals, and we talk about the speed of light and all the rest of it, and that things break up when they reach that speed. But these particles, of which the entire universe is made up of, can communicate without any signal passing between them. So this idea of non-local communication and interconnectivity arises from Bohm's hidden variables paper. And because the local emerges from the non-local, then there is no conflict between the macro and the micro. And that's how Bohm solved it.
Right, right. That once you have that these two are communicating or in some ways united over a phenomenal distance without signal, then sort of the conclusion you need is that they must be one. And if they are one,
exactly.
If they
now
are
you've
one,
got it absolutely.
Yeah. If they are one, then all is one. And he then says that there is this implicate order beneath or pre-emergent of what we see when we bump into a wall or pick up a glass. That there's an implicate order underneath that, and that then leads him to the whole philosophical realm of oneness and connectivity and his relationship with Krishnamurti and so on, that is the thing which a lot of people who probably don't know a quantum from a quark is what they think of Bohm, is that he was a philosopher. But his what you have pointed out and what the film makes clear is that, as you said earlier in this conversation, his philosophy doesn't arise from just thinking stuff. His philosophy arises from his understanding of the physical universe. And my guess is that's what makes him important. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, that's terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus usually 8 or 10 articles that are relevant to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site. Or email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y. at mac.com. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at Apple Podcasts and most podcast sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G and Productions, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Paul Howard. Keep up your good work.